As an economist, I loathe monopoly. I regard it as a form of taxation on the productive capacity of the human population in this country.
And there we have it, Dr. Terry Dwyer, summing up the essence of what this show's on about, removing the control of monopoly over our very freedoms. We may be able to vote, but what does that do for what we can really, really do with our lives when so much of it revolves around wallets? Wouldn't it be great if we could all live on alternative communities? Would we like that? Would we still have broadband? Would we still have $8 made in China pairs of jeans? Would we have all these so-called modern Wiscom gadgets? Well, today, ladies and gents, you know we've been monitoring the housing affordability crisis. Well, again, housing finance figures were out for March, and the number of loans for construction fell by 7.3% to be down by 15% over the first quarter of this year. Yes, 15%. The property elite understand that it's too risky to build houses now. The price is 9 times the average wage versus what we can generally afford is that 3 times the average wage for a mortgage. And worse than that, loans for the purchase of new dwellings fell by 3.2% in the month of March to be 14% lower over the quarter. Compounding this, there was no recovery from first home buyers, so they're not bailing out the market either. So between comparing this March 2010 to March 2009, there was some 50% difference between similar borrowings. But of course, these sucker punch mum and dad investors are stepping into the breach. They're the ones buying investment properties now. They're the ones going to be screaming. Are they going to be the ones getting a bailout? Whew, I dare not say that will be the case. Well, we had the Swan budget last night. They're predicting we've got the rosiest terms of trade in 60 years. That's looking at our export prices. And they're saying that because of this commodity boom feeding off the never-ending Chinese juggernaut, it's going to add 2.75% to nominal GDP. Yes, that's 1/3 of all growth is predominantly reliant upon China. Wow, is that going to happen? This is the most rapid budgetary turnaround since the 60s was Swan's big catch call. Well, what is Treasury analysing if, for example, the Chinese economy doesn't keep moving as it's supposed to be? It's quite something to see what's going on in Europe. Massive, massive bailouts there. Goodness me, how many billions of dollars have been thrown there to bail out the bankers? And that's what they're doing. They're getting their money out of Greece. They're getting their money out of Europe. And it's Michael Hudson's written a new piece on his website, michael-hudson.com, comparing this to America's TARP program. And everyone knows how much of a joke that was in terms of helping the everyday person. Well, the same thing's happening here in Greece. Well, back to Australia. What has good old Swanee done for us? Well, he's revamped the first home buyer account scheme. And there was just a puny 16,000 people taking up this offer. They were expecting over 400,000 participants by this time. And what it does, this reform, is it allows savers to purchase their home before the 4-year term of the account expires, rather than force anyone breaking this 4-year contract to transfer their savings to a super fund. Well, yeah, that's pretty minimal. I think I'm going to get $450 extra over this year in tax cuts. But really, they're trying to play the game, the ALP, that they are the responsible economic managers. Well, what a tragedy. They're just totally ignoring this boom-bust, asset bubble nature of modern economics. And they're thinking that we're out of the woodwork. We can believe Chinese statistics. We can believe a one-day rally in the US stock market after the bailout announcement. We are seriously concerned of the nature of economic policy. Thank goodness me, the Henry Review gave us some hope that there will be an alternative to this Ben Bernanke type bail out the bankers mentality, because in China, land prices have increased by 106% last year, according to Standard Chartered. And that includes 200% in Shanghai and so forth. All right, we're on to Dr. Terry Dwyer. Sit back and listen to him tear apart our budget and our economic future. Terry's been on the show before. And we welcome to the Renegade Economist, Dr. Terry Dwyer, visiting fellow at the Crawford School of Economics and Government at the ANU. Dr. Dwyer, great to have you on the Renegade. What was your interpretation of the Swan-Rudd budget from last night?
Well, in a way, there wasn't much change, but I suppose what would concern me is that they think a $40 billion budget deficit or whatever is acceptable in circumstances where the economy has really not suffered a recession and we aren't in trouble. And if we do get hit by a global tsunami through a real participation in the global financial crisis, which has largely passed us by, then we've shot all our powder before we even have to deal with it.
And that's certainly looming on the horizon, as today we can see that the new housing data figures are throwing a bit of a wobbly, and it's the fifth consecutive fall in loans for construction and the sixth consecutive decline in total lending for housing. So that's saying something about these interest rates. Are we out of the woods?
No, we aren't. I think we may be living in a fool's paradise, because anyone who thinks that China can keep on buying our stuff and selling to Europe, given the problems of geriatric welfare states there and their budgetary problems, and America and Britain, all the major consuming countries financed by debt, are in trouble. How then can China keep going? Now, obviously, there's internal development in China, and they're trying to shift their development from exports to internal development. But I hope people haven't missed the call reports on excess capacity in Chinese steel mills, for example. I mean, at the moment, everybody thinks everything will continue going. But historically, booms tend to be followed by busts, particularly in mining. And this country's had more than its fair share. And I'm not complaining, by the way. I mean, when I heard Lindsay Tenner saying how hard it was to manage a mining boom and this is the problems we have and et cetera, et cetera, I felt like saying, well, would you have preferred that God gave this country nothing? I mean, most countries envious and can't believe that we are being so stupid in not capturing these transitory resource rents for permanent development. And that's one criticism I would make very strongly of this government, as with other governments, and have no party political interest in this. Most of them spend what is essentially partly a capital payment, namely the surrender of your natural resources in perpetuity. Most of them don't earmark it for capital works, such as railways or roads or things of permanent value to society. They just use it for current spending to buy votes.
Now, that is of interest with the infrastructure fund that has been confirmed in the budget papers, that there will be a $700 million investment each year in infrastructure. I still haven't seen the detail on where that infrastructure is going to be built, but I think it's one of the trade-offs in the super profits resource tax that is going to affect the miners, in that the majority of that infrastructure will be in fact building roads and rail that will assist this digging up of our beautiful country.
I'm not what you might call an eco-fundamentalist, and I don't mean to insult anyone by saying that. I'm not one of these people who says you should never change a natural source or dig it up. But I do say, like most people, that if you dig something up and you've got rid of it forever, you should get something permanent in return. And therefore, when it comes to infrastructure, what astonishes me is that when this government and other governments have talked recently about infrastructure, notwithstanding an explosion in electricity and water costs in the cities, all of which feeds into production and the competitiveness of our manufacturers and the cost of our living standards and wage costs, none of them have talked about building new power stations or building dams. In fact, we've been locked into a high-cost infrastructure through these ridiculous desalination projects. I mean, for Melbourne, for example, to have a desalination when you've got Gippsland rivers regularly flooding every 5 years or so is just nonsense. It's just saddling consumers and businesses in Sydney and Melbourne with perpetually high costs.
There could well be a line of attack on this with the new national broadband network that the government has put a directive in place upon that project to deliver a return on investment for the government with the rollout of the broadband fibre optics. So I'm wondering whether this return on investment could well flow through to other areas of the economy.
Well, this is actually where I think one of the great furphies has gone on in modern economics. Truth is, governments should not expect to get a direct return on infrastructure. And by the way, I must declare a personal interest here. With Telstra, I gave a submission to the parliamentary committee, the Senate committee, when I was working there in the Senate, saying that basically if I own Telstra as a monopoly, I would not be selling it. In fact, I would be retaining it for the public benefit. But if they were stupid enough to sell an integrated monopoly, then I was happy to buy. And in that sense, I declare myself an opponent of the NBN for my personal selfish reasons, that I bought a monopoly and I expect to get the benefits of it. However, as an economist, I have to say that's utterly against the public interest. And the truth is the government should never have sold Telstra. If it wanted to, it should have taken Telstra's assets, hired off a link bit, kept the public assets as the backbone for what could be an NBN. And now we're in this ridiculous position where we had Optus and Telstra racing down streets in Sydney and Melbourne, putting up parallel cabling, duplicating the investment we needed to, wasting billions. That's all gone now. Now we're going to have it done again with an NBN to replicate what Telstra could do more cheaply. The truth of the matter is it would have been cheaper for the government to buy back Telstra. But, I mean, after all, they've flogged off Telstra, what is it, $7.50, it's now about $3. They could buy it back more cheaply and get a functioning business. But anyway, let's leave that aside. The general principle is that all these infrastructure works, roads, railways, gas pipelines, dams, water mains, these sorts of things, all service sites. They all service places and land where economic activity goes on. And in that sense, they add to the value of the land. And that's why, for example, in the Burdekin River Irrigation Scheme, the farmers are extremely angry there that they are being forced to pay a rate of return, as you put it, on the assets of Sun Water, the Queensland Government's monopoly irrigation provider. And they're angry because they know when they bought their land, they paid market prices for those blocks and bought them as service blocks with access to infrastructure. So they contributed to the infrastructure they're now being asked to pay a rate of return on. And by the way, the Commonwealth gave the Queensland Government, I think it was $150 million, as a free grant to build the dam. So in a way, what you have now with this paradox is a paradox. The infrastructure that was built in the past for irrigation, for Sydney Water, Melbourne Metropolitan Board of Works, all of this stuff has been paid for in the past by ratepayers and others, and treasuries are now turning around and saying, oh, we want a rate of return on our assets. Never mind, they never paid a bloody cent for them. They are demanding a rate of return on assets that are paid for by previous generations of taxpayers, ratepayers and users. And in effect, what they're doing is taxing production. And really what a sensible government would do is recognise what the New South Wales government did when it built the Sydney Harbour Bridge. When it built the Sydney Harbour Bridge, it knew that a large number of the, that a few Ford Model Ts would never pay for the cost of a construction like that. And a third of the money came from the New South Wales Treasury's general revenue. A third they expected to pay off through borrowings paid off by tolls, but a third came from the landholders on both sides of the harbour because they knew very well, and everybody knew, that land values on the North Shore and the city would rise once communication was made easier with the North Shore. But this is a general principle that all this network infrastructure, which is physically situated and connects land, should never operate on a profitable basis, because to do so is to burden production. What they should operate on is a principle of recovering the fixed costs from the rate, the landholders who benefit through rates, and only charge the users for the actual marginal cost of their use, which is often very small or nil. I mean, that's why public roads are free.
Once upon a time, and the whole aim of this was to rein in the power of monopoly rights over these natural monopolies, and from that keep the costs of running a business or running a household extremely low. But under neoliberalism, that's all changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, because frankly, I went to a thing at the Economic Society a few years ago, and when Graham Samuel was appointed chairman of the ACCC, and he talked about the role of the ACCC in controlling monopoly. And I got up and was a bit rude, I suppose, but he'd given his talk and he'd mentioned about the need for water monopolies to get a proper rate of return on their assets. And I think I got up and said something like this. I mean, it's only from memory. I'm not sure how good my memory is, but I said something like this. I said, look, I was very interested in your comments about water authorities undercharging under national competition policy and they should get a rate of return on their assets. But I must say something, that as an economist, I loathe monopoly. I regard it as a form of taxation on the productive capacity of the human population in this country. But as an investor, I love it. And I'll buy into any monopoly I can find. And I must say, from that point of view, I'm glad that you don't seem to know the difference between the two. I don't think you knew what to say about that. But the trouble is, this shows the problem. Most of the people running competition policy or economic policy in this country have never properly studied the history of economic thought. They think that if you can put a value on an asset, that represents something you should get a rate of return on. They never understand that values may reflect not a contribution to production, but an investment against it. I mean, if they were around in the 1850s, they would be arguing on this sort of principle that southern gentlemen should be getting a proper market rate of return on their slaves. And if they weren't, they should be flogging them harder. I mean, the trouble is that just because something has a value does not mean it represents any real socially useful investment. Instead of having them as public utilities, public works, to improve the productive capacity of the economy, we've turned them into tax collection mechanisms. And you see it in Sydney now, where so many of the roads are turned into tax collection mechanisms, and you get these ridiculous notices from their tollways, and even if you're interstate, you get hit with them. And all this is a wasted effort, just collecting taxes for the benefit of, dare I say it, Macquarie Bank, in which I declare I have some shares. But it's just nonsense. It's just a form of what the medieval or pre-revolutionary French times would have been called tax farming.
That's Dr. Terry Dwyer. Dr. Terry Dwyer discussing monopolies, the budget, the Henry Review. Gee whiz, this oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico, 5,000 barrels a day, and what, they're inserting golf balls in there to sort it out? We'll do a search on YouTube for hay. You can throw hay in oil and it soaks it up, as well as condensed wax. There's mushrooms even, some special sort of mushrooms soak up oil. But instead, the US government a couple of years ago did legislation to say that only BP, the people who caused the spill, could control what could fix it up. Jeez, those dispersants.
In the last couple of weeks, we've gone from a visionary document in the Henry Tax Review to a budget from Swan last night that really was very much a conservative budget. Really, there wasn't much vision from the government in response to the Henry Review, was there?
Not really, and let me be fair to the government. Apparently there was a report. Personally, as I said, I don't particularly care about politics or politicians. Living in Canberra for 30 years is enough to turn you off them completely. But to be fair to the government, I think there was a leak where one cabinet minister said the Henry report was 1,000 pages of thoroughly bad ideas. Now, that is unjust. But I can see why now, having looked at it and even glanced at it, why cabinet ministers would have taken fright. because there are some things in the Henry Report that I think are plain silly. One of them is getting rid of dividend imputation and reintroducing the double taxation of dividends. Another one I thought that was silly was the idea of bringing back death duties, and I thought, gee, that would encourage people to shift the legal ownership of assets offshore. And I thought, well, you know, great marketing for a lawyer who specialises in tax planning, but, you know, I'm not sure it's sensible. But they did have one good idea, and I'm glad they picked it up from the submissions we did, and that was the Henry Review did finally acknowledge, and it's a first, I think, for Treasury, that land is different from capital, that land and natural resources are different from man-made capital like plant, buildings, equipment, and so on, and that there was a case that assets such as land and natural resources, which are the common property of the community held through the Crown, should be levied with peculiar taxation. And that's why I am sympathetic to their view that the miners should pay a resource rent tax. I think it's stupid that they've called it a super profits tax, because it's not a super profits tax. It's really just a payment to use a natural resource given to you by the Crown. The Crown is the ultimate owner. Personally, I would cut through a lot of the argument the miners are putting up and simply say to them, look, if you don't want to pay on the basis of measured receipts and cash flows, and I understand this is a problem for you, and it's a problem for us because we don't have the public servants competent enough to value mines or look at their receipts, let's make it simpler. You can put a value on your mines, mine by mine, and we'll charge you 5-6% government bond rate on them. We'll take the low rate of return, if you like. But if you don't want to pay it on your own valuation, we can buy you out at your own valuation and flog it to someone else. And I think that would sort of flush them out. So I don't think Treasury has gone about taxing mineral resource rents in the most straightforward or efficient manner. It's trying to do the calculations in the tax, which really are the business of the market. So rather than fighting the market to establish a valuation for natural resources, why not use the taxpayer to give you the information that he can work out for himself? But New Zealand did something like this back about the turn of the last century, 1900s. And it's a really a pretty good method for flushing out the valuation. And then, of course, once you've got the valuations and you can compare them, you can gradually improve your data and improve the administration of the tax. But my worry with the resource rent tax, or the super profits tax as it's being mistakenly labelled, is that it will be so complex in the administration that, like Lloyd George's 1910 attempt to value land in the UK and so on, that we'll all fall over and never get to the starting post.
What is some of that complexity? I mean, for me, when I read about it, there's a 40% resource rent tax above any profits made on the 10-year corporate bond rate. And whilst that has been criticised as being low, because generally you would add about 2 or 3% on top of the corporate bond rate as a...
For equity capital, yeah.
...as an average rate of return, but the government's countered that by saying, listen...
We're only taking 40, not 100. Exactly.
But they're also saying we're giving you a lower benchmark for super profits because we're giving you these exploration tax write-offs and all this bonus infrastructure we're going to build for you. So come on, guys.
Yeah, see, this is the problem. Once you get into these debates, it's very easy for your opponents to bamboozle the public with pseudoscience and technicalities. And I think if I were the government, I'd stick to a straightforward principle, namely who owns the resources. It's the Crown for the whole of the Australian people, and it's shared between states and federal government. And I would, in this regard, be totally considerate of the views of state governments. Obviously, they have legitimate rights here. But I would be saying, let's start from first base. These mines are valuable. Otherwise, you wouldn't be interested in screaming so much. You put your valuation on it, and we'll tax you on that. And if you put a low valuation on it, we have the right to buy you out, and you can't squeal because it's obviously just compensation because we're buying you out at your own valuation.
Sun Yat-sen was the first to propose this.
Well, talking about putting their own spin on things, the most bizarre angle to this whole debate is that, according to Peter Martin, the Age journalist, if you analyse the Mineral Council of Australia's proposal for a resource rent tax, they essentially recommended everything that the government took on board. So in terms of lack of consultation and so forth, it really is quite staggering that the mineral companies are coming out saying, listen, basically this is unheard of. How can they dare do this to us?
Oh, this is Bolshevism. Yes, yes. And terrible stuff, you know. Never mind, we happily agreed to it in PNG and other places around the world. I mean, we've happily agreed to it in the offshore oil and everything else. I mean, my criticism is actually that, in a way, the government has not pressed the prerogatives of the Crown more and said, hang on, let's remember whose bloody property this is before we get going. And there is a technical problem with resource rent taxes, is because, like many taxes, it depends on records, receipts, allocations of costs and profits. The real technical problem you've got in administering it is that it requires companies to keep very careful records of their activities mine by mine. And most companies don't necessarily keep their accounting records that way. So you introduce an opportunity, just like with income tax, for transfer pricing, where costs, say, of one area can be allocated to another, and this is a whole argument that raises up itself up, whereas really from the point of view of taxing the resource rent, you should say, this is this mine, this is the leasehold or the tenement for this mine, what's the value of that, and do it physical site by physical site, and that way not worry about the opportunities for people cross-claiming costs or allocating overheads for head office in Melbourne to some mine in Western Australia, etc., etc. The value of land in Australian cities outweighs the value of mines. I mean, this country can be and should be a tax haven. In the late 1880s, it was. I mean, governments raised all their money through land revenues. The only trouble was they sold off the land forever instead of renting it out. If they'd rented it out, we would be more competitive than Singapore, Hong Kong, or anywhere else.
Harry, thank you very much for joining us today on The Renegade Economist.
You're welcome.
There we go. We're still hyped, absolutely hyped, over the Henry Review and the fact that it covered a lot of the core issues we wanted, even adopted the terminology of land value taxation. And this is the way to remove the speculative profits that are hurting so many families, causing so many arguments, because we're all paying so much interest to banks that's built on the back of the land price itself. Yes, I got cut off there before, but make sure you check out the oil leak situation in the Gulf of Mexico. It is a tragedy. And do a YouTube search for hay. Yes, your average farming hay can soak up oil, so can mushrooms, so can condensed wax. So there's all sorts of alternatives out there. But of course, BP is using the most toxic pollutants out there on the seafloor, killing off the very start of the food chain in the seabed. So yeah, it's tragic. One day the world will come to its senses. Let's hope it's soon. Things are unfolding very fast in Europe, and we're looking forward to...
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Bringing you